to that chip. They would change it from game to game. Not too often. You had to have a real special game to get that chip changed, because in those days you had to send the program to Japan so it could be burned into the chip and shipped back here. They didn't program things. So you had to have a really good game to get Norm Clark and Frank Branca's blessing to have a chip made. So they changed it for Paragon. They changed it for, I think, Harlem Globetrotters. I don't know why. And they changed it, and of course you had the original one burned for A Lost World. So after, when Gorgar came out, the speech craze started coming, they said, well, you know what, we got to have our own soundboard. We can't use this analog sound chip, because Williams has got their own chip. So they came out with the microprocessor control chip, and you'll see one right up there on the screen. That was actually built around a newer generation Motorola chip. Used a 6802 chip, I believe. And the 6802 chip was designed so that it could use, it had memory built onto it. And then the Motorola rep came and said, well, you know, we got a warehouse full of memory chips, so why don't you just use the cheaper 6808 chip and we'll give you these memory chips for free. And that's why it has the extra chip on there. But if you could pull that chip off and put the other processor on it, it would still work. So that one, I was directly involved with the construction of that. Later on, towards the late years of Valley, they wanted to go back to that, so they kind of redesigned that board, and because it was a less expensive board, I think the great Lance Chantry came up with the name Cheap Squeak, and that was the lower, less expensive board. So now I get asked a lot of questions about Xena. What went on with that game? And I assume that everybody in this room has seen Xenon and heard the stories of Xenon, story of Xenon. Xenon had been around for a long time. It hadn't been called Xenon. Greg Kamek had this idea for a playfield with this little tube running across it. And it sat in the lab for a long time, because in those days, they thought a tube was very, very radical. Incredible. Getting the ball off the playfield in the air. Holy cow. And then Williams came out with a multi-level game, Black Knight. You guys might have heard of that one. Well, there's nothing wrong with getting a ball up in the third dimension there. So let's do that. So we're going to make this game. And they came up with Xenon. And they figured out how to make a soundboard for it. They called it the vocalizer board. So they did that. And this was the board where, for make the sounds, they had an artist named Susan Chiani. I don't know if I spelled it right or not. But
you got the last name right.
That was with a Z. Suzanne with a Z?
No. Suzanne with an A.
Close. That's what I get for not cutting and pasting off Google. But she actually did a lot of the research on those boards. And all I know is they brought a tape into the lab. And they said, here, we want to put these into a game. I said, okay. And the tape was about 45 minutes long. They had all these sounds. Probably an hour, probably 10, 20 minutes worth of groans. Like saying, Xenon. All right, so how do you pick the sound? You can't put them all on the board. So they took the sound, they put them on a tape, they went into the conference room, and for 2.5 days, Greg and some of our programmers just sat in a room listening to groans and moans. They took a break for lunch, and they went back in listening to groans and moans. That's it. Let's hear that one again. That's it. Number 12. We'll go with that one. Okay, we're going to tie that to this button, and that's to that. And I thought the game was still pretty boring. I'm working in the lab, and I'm testing it. So it's just for kicks. I took a second pinball out of the thing. I threw it out of the playfield. Hey, it was pretty cool. I got two balls flying around the playfield. So I called Greg over. You got to see this. Look at this. I threw a ball on the playfield. Ooh, that's pretty good. The next thing I know, everybody from the game department is down in the lab, and they're all throwing extra balls on the playfield. Well, we got to make this a multi-ball game. We got to do this. Now, Bally invented multi-ball, I think, with firepower at 4 million BC a long time ago.
Balls a popping.
What's that?
Balls a popping.
Balls a popping? The first one I saw was fireball at 4 million BC. And it went away. And I remember I asked Greg and I asked some of the other engineers, I said, why don't we bring out a multi-ball game? Well, nobody liked multi-ball. The Germans would come in the lab, or the French would come in the lab, and they go, you bunch of guys, you thought you should have thought about trainers and good. Okay, so they don't want it, we can't do it anymore. And then Williams came out with Think Fireball. And next thing you know, everybody wants multiple. So They freaked. They saw this extra ball just rolling. It didn't do a darn thing for the game, by the way, but it looked cool and it made the game fun. So the next thing I know, they're all in the lab and they're modifying the pieces. And the software guy, he's up and he wants to kill me because now he knows he's going to have to go in and rewrite the code for the multi-ball program. So how hard can it be? It doesn't do anything. You just kick the ball out. Well, it's more complicated than that because you've got to track the ball. They put so many checks and balances into that software to make sure that you knew where the ball was, you wouldn't launch at the wrong time, that my phone rang off the hook for the next year. Oh, my Xenon won't work. Well, because it doesn't know where the ball is. Well, I checked all the switches. Well, I go check them again because it just doesn't know where the ball is. That's why I won't start. I've changed the motherboard 3 times. Well, hope you get a refund. So that's really the story. That's really the backstory behind that. We got the sounds in. We did a special soundboard for that game only, because this is the speech vocalizer, and it's basically the original soundboard linked up to a more compact memory card. And it's almost like a one of a kind. We actually stuck it in the next game, Flash Gordon. However, we came up with Squawk and Talk. And I've been over this story. Does anybody know where that name came from? Squawk and Talk. Anybody heard the story?
No.
Anybody heard of Speak and Spell? Well, Speak and Spell, hot toy in the late 70s, early 80s. Text instruments couldn't make enough of them. So the TI rep came into the lab. Here's the chip. You guys should try it. So I remember Ackerman and Kahn and a couple of the engineers, they set it up on a test board and put it into a test loop. Okay, so for a month, you heard big, dog, ugly, astronaut, astronaut, eat, ugly, monkey, monkey, astronaut. You could go out to lunch without one of the guys saying, that is incorrect, spell monkey. It didn't say monkey, it said monkey. That's incorrect, spell astronaut. To this day, my kids hate me because I'll walk around the house someday and go, spell monkey. L-U-N-K, no, that's incorrect, spell monkey. So they so TI had this design. So they remodeled, they re-engineered Speak and Spell. And again, king of the funny names, Lance Chantry, he came up with Squawk and Talk, Speak and Spell. So the name, and it's the name stuck. I thought they were going to get rid of the name. The name stuck because they didn't know. They said, oh, that's cool. It got a cool, funny name. People will buy the product. So this is a Squawk and Talk board, and it went through a few different modifications. Now this board, actually, in this picture, is not one of the newer ones. However, you look at the bottom right-hand corner, you'll see that there is like a 16-pin connector, but it only uses 4. Because they engineered into this a digital sound control. So instead of using a potentiometer, they were actually going to have a setting in the microprocessor setups where you could digitally set the volume up. And that would have required a special input plug. They never activated it except on some of the test games we did. So that was what was on there. And the board had to have its own 5-volt power supply. And I think I re-laid this board out because in those days I did a lot of the PC work and I did a lot of the parts acquisition. So I think I relayed this board out 10 times just to fix it and make it unique. So now we have the power supply. So probably the second most common question or comment I hear from people. So, oh, you're a Valley engineer? So how come those power supplies always burned up? Second most common. You probably can guess what the first most common one is, but we'll talk about the second one first. First most common question is, why did the power supplies burn up? You know, I actually had a very close relationship with the connector manufacturer, our guy from AMP at the time. Came in, and the first design of the power supply, if you've ever seen it in Knight Rider and some of the older games, the board sits right on top, flat, right on top of the power supply. And we figured, well, all that heat is rising off there, so that's what's cooking, that's why the connectors are getting hot. So we redesigned it, like you see in the picture here, with the board mounted flat. And if the connectors still burn up. They still burn up and they melt. So the AMP people said, well, you know, you need the new style connector. It has 3 flanges on it. We call it a trifurcon. You switch to that, it'll be fine. We did. They still burned up. So eventually, our European distributors threatened not to import our games anymore if we did not fix the power supply. And that's when Doug McDonald and I came up with the newer one, the Xenon power supply, which had the plugs, and those did not burn. Those do not burn up. Cute little story there is they coat the bottom of the rectifiers with a grease, so it'll conduct heat. So when the board is bolted into its metal chassis, it the heat conducts out of the bridge rectifiers into the metal chassis. That was a nice concept. And then the vendor from the grease company came out and said, we had a new thing. It's a stick-on pad. You just peel this off, and you stick this on the back of the rectifier, and you don't need the greaser anymore. And I said, that's a good idea, because it was a real mess down in the shop. It wasn't environmentally friendly. It gave off fumes and everything. So this is great. So they started using it. I ordered like 200 to test out. And the guy from the shop calls me up. He says, well, we can't use these. Why? Well, you can't put them on. What are you talking about? Went down to the shop. The guy responsible for putting the grease on had no fingers on his hand. So he couldn't peel them off the sheet. But he could grip a brush to brush the grease on. Okay. All right, so this is the first most common suggestion people say to me. They say, well, did you know NiCad batteries leak and destroy their boards? No. I did not. No research on it at the time. I did have a textbook which told me that NiCad was good. You could recharge it. And Williams was putting out games that you had to replace the batteries on. So this has got to be a better idea, right? 20 years later, people say, you know, I got this old game, and you look at this picture. It's all the copper is melted. Oh, it's out of warranty. Sorry. yeah, here's the deal. I guess if you do not recharge them, they won't leak. But if you recharge them every day, the recharging process it causes a chemical reaction, which causes the leak. Who knew? State of the art at the time. Oh, that's it. Let me go back to my timeline. Okay, so I'm just going to go back here just to the timeline, and then what I'd like to do is let you guys just ask me questions. How are we doing? Because this is the original timeline. The last thing we worked on was the video Pac-Man game. And Steve Ackerman actually had a unique chip that he came up with that did video. And he reprogrammed Pac-Man. If anybody knows the story behind Pac-Man, came over from Japan, a company named Namco, some developers out there created the game, brought it over to our lab, and we brought it in there, and we futzed around with it and made it marketable in the U.S. And it was moderately successful. We sold a few. Put them on the assembly line one summer when pinball sales were slow. And last I thought, isn't Midway still making them? I was in Costco, I think I saw them. So Steve rewrote the whole program and put it onto his board, which he called the Vidiot. And has anybody ever been able to play that that game for getting past level 2 on that? Because I never could. What?
No. I get free game.
You actually were able to do that? It just. Anyway, okay, whatever. There's a couple of experiments. So the big projects we worked on was new technology. So the first game you saw was an Intel chip. Intel came to us and says, well, you're building with Motorola. Can you do something with our chip? And we did a game called KISS, which you might have heard of. And occasionally you'll see a KISS out there. It'll have these blue fluorescent displays. That's a prototype game using an Intel processor. And then they said, well, let's do the same thing with Motorola. And so Motorola said, we could use our 6809 series chips. And we did a game, we redid 8-Ball Deluxe. So you'll be walking around and you'll see some 8-Ball Deluxe games, and they'll have those blue vacuum fluorescent displays, which nobody liked, by the way, but hey, they're a lower voltage. They're getting kind of queasy about having 190 volts out there. So those are the two prototype games that are floating around in addition to a few of the others. And they're, you know, no one can support them, but there are a couple of guys. I understand there's John Moore is out there somewhere. He actually has one and knows how to get it up and running. I used to have all that material. Matter of fact, I think one of the original schematics is sitting up here for those experimental games. 1983, they closed the pinball division down. People like me had to go get a real job. But I kept a lot of the souvenirs. Actually, at the time, 1983, I was slated to head up service over at Aladdin's Castle. But I elected to go into telecommunications. I go out and get a real job instead of playing games. But they closed the division down. Some of the guys, like Mike Miller, got on his Harley, just went riding, was never heard from again. Some of the guys, they went over to Bally, which became Life Fitness. And they started an engineering group up there. And there may be a couple of them still at Life Fitness today. But that was the timeline, guys. I just like to, you know, I got a question up front here.
How about the interaction with any of the people doing the bingo machines to make those solid state people?
Yeah, bingo was on the way out about the time that I came in. There were a few bingo games in there, and we actually did do some work with the electronics bingo, but that went over to the Midway group to do what was left there. I don't think they produced very many bingo games as we got into the 80s. Other questions? Anything about?
So when they did in 1984, when they went to the 6803 process, so if you guys were closed down, who was making that?
Midway. So they took all of the remaining people, and they combined Bally Pinball in Bensonville with Midway in Franklin Park, and they called it the Bally Midway team. So they actually produced, I think, a game called Motor Dome. In fact, I called Greg up, and I said, what's with this Motor Dome? You finally put this new thing into production? So they basically took the stuff that we had done and refined it a little bit more, and that's how that came about.
What was the delay between the closing and then that reorganization thing? I mean, how much time expired?
Repeat the question, please.
What was the delay? How much time went by? Well, we closed in the end of 1983 is when the pinball division officially closed its doors. In that time period from the spring to the fall, they transferred a lot of components and parts and resources there. But the thought was that Midway could produce pinballs as easily as they produced video games. So it should be no big deal. We'll give the Jim Patlin and Norm Clark a cubicle, and they'll just keep doing what they're doing. But the reality was they just lost so much expertise in that transition. It was very hard for them to regain any momentum. And as you know, a few years later, Williams acquired the pinball assets of Bally Midway.
I had two questions written down and two comments.
Sure.
One comment, Harlem Globetrotters and Paragon and all the games following, they had different, each game had a unique sound for the 10-point, 100-point, 1,000-point, and the extra music and stuff. All the games before that had exactly the same sound for the 10-point, 100-point, 1,000-point, with different melodies for Game Start, Game Over, and Saucers and stuff. But one game, Playboy, actually had a different 10-point sound in it, and I was wondering if that's what you were referring to when you said if a really good game came along, they could get a different chip for it. Did Playboy have a different chip?
No, they did not consider that a really good game. Harlem Globetrotters was considered a good game. No, they did not. Again, it worked. It was a pecking order. You had to know the right people and do the right amount of begging to get that chip changed. But Playboy came out early in the process. So the sounds that had been created had not been taken up by Lost World. But when it came time for Dolly and a few of the other games, all the good sounds had been taken. They wanted new sounds. And I forgot, which was the Williams game came out around that period that was the first ever microprocessor in it. Was it, what was it?
Hot tip.
No, it was another one. Not another one. The digital, the microprocessor soundboard was in a Williams game.
Like Flash?
World Cup.
Pre-Flash. Bally produced a copy of it a few years later.
World Cup.
No, it wasn't World Cup. It was
Phoenix?
Flash, Firehawk. I can't remember the name of it. But anyway, Williams came out with the first microprocessor. It was so good. There was nothing you could do with that analog board, absolutely nothing. And it was impossible to fix, it was difficult to support. It was so much easier for the engineers to just go in and stick a Motorola chip on it and stick an A to D converter on it and make sounds.
Okay.
Because they really thought that the play field and nothing else mattered. If it had cool sounds, the game would sell. Even though you got into an arcade, you really couldn't tell what game was making what noise. It really didn't matter. You had a question back there.
I came in a little late, and I apologize if this question or you did deal with this already. Can you talk to the non-wood playfields of that valley era, like KISS and such? What brought them about research?
KISS had an experimental playfield material. So what are you looking for in a playfield? You're looking for something that's inexpensive, that will not warp and less. So they actually had different playfields. If you look around and you see a pilot run game, and the way you could tell, the Bally serial numbers all started at 1,000. It's like the first 300, when you have 1,000 to 1,300, are usually the pilot run. You will sometimes see these, if you look at the cross-section of the playfield, it's usually made out of an alternative material, composites. They tried fiberglass. They tried different types of plastics. The bottom line was that Bally owned a part of Link Smith, the woodworking company. So Link Smith didn't work with those materials. So basically, you were going to take business away from a company which you had a financial interest in, and that is why wood remained the material of choice pretty much for the most of that era. But you'll spot, every once in a while, you'll see a game, serial number 1200, might maybe... I think they put them on Star Trek. I think they put them on Nitro Ground Shaker. And you look at it and say, this isn't wood. This is some other material. And that was where just to make them happier, because they would give somebody a few thousands of dollars and say, hey, go out and give us an alternative play field. Just to make them happy. All right, we'll buy 300 of them. We'll do that. Can we dive back there?
Yeah,
I'm not really sure about that. However, I'm almost positive it came out of the O'Donnell. That Mr. O'Donnell had a group of friends that he was very tight with. He had his own personal network, and he would often go to them for advice. And Angela, many times in engineering, we had no control. They would just bring us something and say, here, we want you to do this. Anybody seen Doodlebug, by the way? The Doodlebug.
Williams.
What the heck is a Doodlebug? Other than the fact that Norm Clark came up with a little pinball to go back and forth. All I know is we were going to do Fireball 2. This is great. I love Fireball. It had that little spinning zipper flippers. I love that game. No, you're not going to put any of that in there. You're going to stick this Doodlebug in the middle of the playfield. Make it work. I did. The game didn't sell. The rest is history. Do you have one more question? Yeah, I thought.
When I was anybody at Texas Pinball Festival in 2004, there was a Playboy machine there that had like a generic cabinet, and it was cut in such a way that you could sit with your legs under it like a counter, and instead of a back glass, it just had this little tiny thing with all the score displays in it. And I couldn't get any kind of explanation of it there. I was wondering if you could confirm or deny whether that was built by the factory, if that was something somebody,
Somebody had way too much time. No, if that came out of the factory, Norm or somebody was working down in the basement one night. I never would see that. We did do a restaurant table. I put one up in Milwaukee. There's one that was in a restaurant. It was still there 10 years later. The restaurant had changed owners. They covered it. We actually took a game, kind of like Bally Alley, laid it on its side, put legs on it, made it a table, put a coin slot on the side, thinking people would play this game while waiting for their food to come. And we did two of those. There was one up in Milwaukee, and there was another one, I think, at a bar here in Chicago. I don't know whatever happened to them.
Is there any flashing light? Type play?
Yeah, imagine if you took Bally Alley and made it into a table. Built two of those. And 10 years later, I left Bally, and I went up in this restaurant, which was like Tomfoolery. Had been sold, and it was a Mexican restaurant. It was in Milwaukee. And it was still there. It didn't work. It was still there. They put a tablecloth on top of it. Don't know whatever happened to them. I think there was one at a restaurant up on Rand Road. I put one in. Doug McDonald and I personally drove those out and hooked them up. We were just trying anything to revive business.
What can you tell us about the development of rapid fire?
You had to bring that up, didn't you? What can I tell you about the rapid fire? It was another rush, panic job. It was a terrible game. Nobody wanted to liked it. However, Williams came out with, was it Hyperball? It was the same thing that went on with the Gorgar game. I'm like, God, they have this game. It's going to shoot balls and make noise. We don't have one. What are we going to do? Oh, I got a ball shooter right here. We'll just stick this into a play field, and we're going to hire, we'll have three shifts of production because we're going to sell millions of these things. I couldn't get mine to work more than one day without the fuse blowing. So I had one up. In those days, I sometimes would put something up in the lunchroom, let the employees play just to see what was going to break. Everything broke on the darn game. we put them out the thing. And you know what? The special cabinet, they ordered so many parts. I think there's still parts in stock for that. They ordered so many. That's where the 8-ball and the Centaur cabinets came from. They were leftover firepower inventory. Matter of fact, I think distributors were so angry they took back carloads of these games, gutted them out, repainted them, and converted them into, 8-ball deluxe limited edition or whatever. I think that's where that came from. It was a rush job. They never tested anything. And I don't know, does anybody still have a working fireball in their collection? Firepower or whatever? Whatever, fire junk, whatever it was. We had a nickname for it. It was Fire Dog. That was our nickname. Everything was Fire Dog. Everything was dog in those days. Do we got time for maybe one more? I got one guy there. No, they weren't selling. I mean, Pitbull, ironically, we did a lot of the development for Pac-Man in our facility, and we were really working to eliminate our jobs. But they had no foresight. You know, Williams, give them credit. They said that there was going to be a market for pinball, maybe not in the volumes, but Williams started putting a lot of money and investment into very innovative ideas in pinball. Bally refused to do it. They only wanted to sell video games. And the funniest story, the last Amway show I attended, I think the last game produced by Stern in that era was a bathtub pinball. And if anybody's ever played that game, I think when it gives you the ball to shoot it, it begs you. It says, play pinball again. And I think that was kind of what the attitude was in those days. But yeah, no, we were not taken by surprise. All of us were pretty much planning the next project of what we're going to go on to.
Just a follow-up, though, real quick. Can you see that start to happen right when Bob Delaney came in and Bill O'Donnell Sr. left? Because he was close pinball and slot machine, versus Mulane, I think, was more on the gaming side and video. Can you see that or not?
You could see it because, we were, the factory and the engineering were together. You could just walk down to the factory and see the layoffs. You could see the people leaving. You could see we lost people in our engineering group. I mean, it just didn't happen in shot. You just knew. You could see the end coming. And we just thought we'd be around for new technology. But pinball went out, and it went through a revival in the late 80s and early 90s. And then, of course, we are where we are today.
I have one last question.
Yeah.
How do you feel about Bally and Stern parts being interchangeable, like displays, boards, whatever? Was that a problem for you guys, or did it matter?
It wasn't a problem for me.
Okay.
The people ask, well, why didn't you sue them, or how is it they just copied your boards and all that? There was, let's put it this way, although there was a lot of disenchantment, it did not hurt being the electronic standard of two manufacturers in the world. That didn't hurt our business. What hurt our business ultimately was not being innovative on the playfield and design side, which after 1980, that's what really hurt the company.
Crazy collector, though, can double up on the parts back.
Some stuff. I think we're running out of time, so what I'd like to do is, you guys want to come up and ask me questions and look at some of my props, that's fine. But look, thanks a lot for giving me my 45 minutes. Thank you.